in just a few moments. But first, let's take a look at the scoring of this one. For the Warriors, they got on the board at 6:43 of the first period. Cooper DePoit with the goal. Chase Crass and Owen Pregalski with the assists. 1-0 West, and that would be the score at the end of the first period. Then the Warriors would add one more goal in the second period. At 8:22 on the power play, Shea Jones with his fourth goal of the season. Cooper DePoit and Chase Crass had the assist, and it was 2-0 Warriors. It would stay that way until the third, and then the Warriors would explode in the third with four goals. At 6:24 the third, a power play goal. Chase Crass got a puck that bounced off a defenseman in front, past the goaltender Bastien to make it 3-0. Then the Warriors, just 49 seconds after that, would score again at 7:13. It was Hendrix Damrow with Cade Damrow and Shea Jones with the assist to make it 4-0. Warriors would make it 5-0 at 11:47. This time it was Cade Damrow with Hendrix Damrow and Joe Gravine with the assist. Then the Warriors made it 6-0 at 16:11, a power play goal. Terrific individual talent play made by Cooper DePoit, unassisted. And then Rapids would ruin the shutout with under 11 seconds to go, 16:49. A break-in, scoring the goal with Nathan Bouchard. Assist on the play went to Christopher Delaney. And that would be it. 6-1, Wausau West over Wisconsin Rapids. On the night, 37 shots on net for Wausau West. 15 shots on net for Wisconsin Rapids. 37 shots, 31 saves made by goaltender Riley Bastien. And 15 shots, 14 saves made by Julian Scalcucci. Now joined by the coach of the Warriors, B.J. Brandt. Solid effort here tonight. Kept the puck in the offensive zone a lot, had a lot of shots. I'm sure you would have liked to have finished a few more early, but at the same time, really, I thought the 51 minutes, you guys kind of kept your foot on the accelerator and played solid hockey.
Yeah, you know, we were a little slow early, like slow in execution. We created chances. That part was good, but obviously we got better as the game went on, which is important. I mean, I told the guys we have to build each period here. We aren't going to be great early. We got to make sure that we get to be better, and I thought our third period was our best period. Obviously, special teams, I think we ended up being 3-for-4 on the power play. I mean, that's huge. We have to score power play goals when given the opportunity. But I thought we got better as the game went on.
Cooper DePoit, a couple of goals, and that last one, I'm sure you and your coaches would like to say take credit for that, but sometimes a talented guy can just make things look really, really cool, and that was a cool goal, wasn't it?
That was a nice shot, short side high. It's fun when guys get the opportunity to do things they do in practice and execute them in a game, because I know he's done that a few times, and for him to do that here is pretty fun to watch.
Shea Jones is really becoming a weapon on the power play, isn't he?
Well, I tell you, he's found a niche over there.
And left faceoff circle.
He likes that spot. He finds his spot. I mean, I thought overall it was one of his better games during the year here. I mean, he's doing some of the things we're asking him to do. You know, sometimes he's physical, and I know that's a big part of his game, but he made some really nice plays today where he wasn't physical. He just played the puck. He managed the puck, got the puck to the forwards, which I felt was a good growth spot for him.
And by the way, DePoit had a birthday, and I saw that today is Ethan Rohde's birthday, so you had a couple birthday boys out there.
Yeah. It's,
I wanted Rohde to score, though, but that...
he scored here, I think. This was his first varsity goal.
Oh, really?
Here at Rapids, yeah. You know, obviously, there at the end, we want to make sure we keep them off the board, and I think there's some frustration. It kind of soured the win with giving up that goal at the end of the game. But obviously, Julian was good. He had to stop breakaway early. But Rapids, like they have weapons, they and they find ways. So it was nice to get out of here with a win.
And I guess finally, you know, you talk about that again. That just shows again. Any moment that you kind of lose that focus for just a moment, it can come back and bite you. Maybe a good time to have the lesson, as much as it probably annoys the goaltender.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't want that lesson for us today, but some, you don't always get the lessons you want, right? And hopefully we learn from it to finish games and to be more, 51 minutes instead of 50 minutes and 49 seconds.
Well, and finally, I guess big game tomorrow. I mean, obviously, because it's a sectional game. You saw them the first game of the season, and they got the two overtime win. I mean, tomorrow night, it's got big significance, doesn't it?
Oh, it's super significant. I mean, obviously, good – good team in Eau Claire Memorial, well-coached team, and they got us in double overtime last time. And, I think it's going to be a fun game for us. I mean, they had a rivalry game tonight. They're playing Eau Claire North. Yeah. We watched a little bit of that in between periods and just trying to prepare for them. I mean, they're a well-coached team. They're a skilled team. I mean, you look at them, you've got to make sure you take care of number 7, take care of number 10. Those are their big offensive threats, and then make sure that the chances we get, we got to make sure we finish.
And I guess finally, you want people to come out? Some great hockey tomorrow and Saturday.
Yeah, I tell you, we got pretty good hockey coming into town. Eau Claire Memorial, Notre Dame, Middleton, some perennial teams, and come out to Marathon Park. I know we play at 6, and I think there's a crosstown rivalry basketball game going on. Can catch that, and then head over to Wausau East and check out the boys basketball team too, and girls basketball team. So yeah, it's going to be a great event. Our parents do a good job putting it on. Looking forward to a good weekend of hockey.
See you tomorrow.
Thanks, Chad.
Head coach of the Warriors, B.J. Brandt. Warriors 6, Wisconsin Rapids, Lincoln 1. Well, that's going to wrap things up here tonight. Thanks again to our sponsors, without whose help we could not bring you Wausau West High School hockey. And don't forget, tomorrow, Saturday, and Monday, we have the Warrior hockey team in action. Tomorrow night, 5:50 for the pregame, 6 o'clock for the opening faceoff, Warriors and Eau Claire Memorial. Thanks to all of you for joining us. Again, I'm Chad Holmes from the Southwood County Recreation Center in Wisconsin Rapids. Wausau West 6, Wisconsin Rapids 1. This has been Warrior Hockey on 98.9 WXCO.
This has been Wausau West Warrior High School Hockey on 98.9 WXCO. Online at WXCO.fm. Mobile devices and Alexa by searching WXCO and on the Civic Media app. Wausau West Hockey has been brought to you by the Cloverbelt Credit Union, Red Robin Restaurants, Sun Printing, the Wausau West Athletic Department, the Wausau West Hockey Booster Club, and Coast to Coast Marketing. Thanks for joining us for Wausau West Warrior High School Hockey on your home for the Warriors, 98.9 WXCO.
Turn into an isolationist situation. And look, I've always said I'm a protectionist. I believe in protecting things. When I leave my house, I lock the door. I don't have a giant moat around it. I protect it, but I'm not isolated from my neighbors. And that's where we need to be. I think what Biden was doing to help manufacturing return by prioritizing some investments and also some targeted policy, good thing. This across the board threat, I think it's a threat. We're not really sure, and this is the bizarre nature of where Trump is at, and what the red hat crowd will tell you is the genius. Look, I get the anger, I get the idea, the belief that America has been taken advantage of. And I would argue, no, we haven't been taken advantage of by other countries. We've been taken advantage of by our own country. The people who lead this country, the business leaders, the people in the business roundtable, our CEO class, our corporate titans. Those are the folks who have taken advantage of us. Because who's gotten wealthy over the last 40, 50 years of tax breaks and deregulation and all of the give the wealthy more crowd? Who's gotten wealthier? Whose standard of living has gone up? Is it you and your children, or is it Doge Boy and his what, I don't know, 50 kids now? That's the question we need to be asking ourselves. And is this policy, do you think it's going to work? Do you think slapping up tariffs on everything is going to make life better for working people? I've had some people who think it is. But in the real world, when costs do go up, and it's harder to get parts from around the world, and it's harder for American companies and American manufacturing to survive, the pain, the inflation, the struggle, that's going to hurt you. It's going to hurt me. It's going to hurt us. It's not going to hurt Doge Boy. It's not going to hurt Vivek. It's not going to hurt Trump. It's going to hurt you and me. Want to hear your thoughts. You buying it? You buying the big, beautiful bill with massive tariffs? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, Michael Linden's going to be here to share some thoughts on tariffs. Maybe he'll disagree with me. Maybe he thinks this is the big, beautiful plan. Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So if you buy what Trump is quote-unquote truthing, and you gotta love the kind of Orwellian doublespeak language, these are truths. No, it's BS. It's nonsense. But, you know, look, get used to it because we're going to see a lot of it. But if you buy what Trump is selling, that with the tax cuts that he's going to do, this one big, beautiful bill, we're not going to tax people who make their living getting tips. He had said at one time, no more taxes on overtime. And the rest of the world, they're going to pay for it because tariffs are a-coming. And it makes me think back to, you remember that wall that Mexico was going to pay for? I kind of think this is going to go the same route, but here to share some thoughts on, is it possible? Is it possible to run a government again on solely tariffs? That's why I've asked Michael Linden to come share some thoughts. He's a senior fellow over at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth, former Biden administration OMB official, and a good friend of the show for a very long time. Michael, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's so nice to be back.
It is great to see you again. You took that hiatus to work for the Biden administration, did great work over there. But let me ask you, I've had a lot of people say, we're not going to have to pay taxes anymore. We're going to, it's going to be great because everybody else, the entire world is going to pay our taxes.
Yeah, that's a nice dream. It's not what's going to happen here. Here's the truth. Here's the nugget of truth in it. Rich people and corporations will pay less in taxes. That's for sure. That if you look at what they are proposing in this big bill that they are talking about, the vast majority, trillions and trillions of dollars, trillions with a T, will be spent on tax cuts that go primarily and overwhelmingly to very, very wealthy people and corporations. And if they are serious about offsetting the cost of that with tariffs, then the question is, who's going to pay that? And of course, he wants people to believe there's a reason that they want folks to believe that other countries pay those tariffs. But the truth is that American consumers pay those tariffs. They're taxes on imported goods. Now, sometimes tariffs can be useful, can be important, can be critical tools, especially when trading partners are not playing by the rules or trying to take advantage of American workers. I think. There's a time and a place for tariffs. Tariffs on bananas from South America is kind of stupid. There's not a big banana industry in the United States. We're not trying to protect that. Who's going to pay tariffs on bananas? Americans who buy bananas. That's the real truth. And so if we are shifting from a situation where billionaires and corporations pay taxes to people who go to the grocery store pay taxes more, that's just a huge wealth shift from the top, from the middle to the top. They're just taking money out of working people's pockets and literally giving it to billionaires and corporations. I just think that's absolutely the wrong way to go. Again, tariffs are not always bad in every situation in every moment, but when you're saying we're going to use higher taxes on working people to pay for lower taxes on billionaires and corporations, it's economically backwards, it's morally backwards, it's indefensible.
When was the last time the U.S., you know, got the majority of its revenue from tariffs? I'm thinking back, you know, 1880s, 1890s.
That's right. Turn of the last century is when most of our revenue came from tariffs. But here's the important things to remember about that, right? The U.S. was not a global superpower at that point. We did not have Social Security. We did not have Medicare. We did not have a robust network of public schools. We did not have the national highway system. We did not have, there's thousands of things that we all depend on and rely on that come from the public sector or partly the public sector, that none of that existed in 1900.
Right.
And you cannot finance Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, public schools, you know.
Isn't that the point, though? I mean, honestly, isn't that, because I've heard a lot of talk about returning to the 1880s and 1890s. I've heard the Trumposphere go, we need to go back to when America was great. And the last Gilded Age is when they believe America was great. So it kind of fits. We're in the middle of the next Gilded Age. Kind of fits that this is where they want to go, no?
I think that's very true. And it's there's something really... you're getting to the heart of it, right? Because what was true, what is the same about the turn of last century and where we are now is extreme levels of income and wealth inequality, right? You had a few, back in the early 1900s, you had a few robber barons who controlled massive corporations with massive amounts of wealth concentrated in just a few hands. And you can basically say the same thing about our economy today. And that is something that I think is not a coincidence. And part of that comes from the fact that we have spent the last 25 years cutting taxes for billionaires and corporations.
Last 40, really.
Yeah. And it's been supercharged in the last 25 years, but you're absolutely right. And, you know, we started cutting taxes for rich people and corporations under Ronald Reagan in 1981. And it was kind of it wasn't a straight line. There were times when we went the other way under Bill Clinton and actually George W. Bush's father, George H.W. Bush, actually raised taxes on wealthier people. But basically since George W. Bush, it has been a one-way ratchet of cutting taxes for corporations and rich people. Today, the richest 400 families in America pay a lower average tax rate than like a firefighter or a nurse. They pay an average tax rate of something like 10% of their income. 10%.
Yeah.
That is lower than a normal everyday worker going out, you know, making a living for their family. They are paying more than a billionaire. It's part of the reason why we have all of this income and wealth inequality. It's part of the reason why we've had such slow growth for so long, why so many people feel like they are working so hard and not getting ahead.
No, the anger is real and justified. You know, when all of those folks that you laid out there paid every dime they're going to pay into Social Security about 10 minutes after midnight on January 1st, and yet working people are paying all year long, kind of something that made me think about. But I want to go back to this for a second because, you know, I've had people who have this vision that we can do this tariff thing, you know, we just have to be committed, kind of like trickle down. We just have to do it enough. Can you possibly raise enough revenue? And are there examples around the world of countries that are using tariffs to fund their operations, to fund their country, to fund their roads and bridges and education and all of that stuff?
Yeah, no to the second question. I mean, no developed country, no country that is anywhere close to the economy that we would want to have. Or, you know, it's possible there are some, you know, what we used to call third world countries, we don't use that term as much anymore, but that are using mostly tariffs. But those are not countries that we should be aspiring to. But to your first question, the math does not work. I mean, that's also just the truth, is that even if you imposed a 20% tax on every single thing that the American people buy that comes from another country, including things like bananas and, you know, cocoa and you know, auto parts that are built in American cars but are made in Canada, what have you, every single thing, it still would not generate as much money as the income tax or the corporate income tax combined. And those taxes, again, those are taxes that are largely and disproportionately paid by wealthier people. They're progressive. The richer you are, the more you pay in income taxes. At least that's the way it's supposed to be. That's been eroded over time, but it's still mostly true. Tariffs, it's the opposite. You know, taxes on imports, taxes on things people buy is the opposite. The poorer you are, the larger share of your income you're going to pay in taxes. And so, again, it's this ridiculous shift of taxation from rich people onto middle and low income people. And the math does not work. You cannot do Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, veterans benefits, national defense, highways, air traffic control safety, these kinds of basic things. You cannot do all of that with just tariffs. It cannot be done, literally. And that is, there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it.
I'd argue that that is the point. And I think it's important. But can you make an argument that, and, you know, just on paper, like, you know, like I coached football for a while. Every play I ever drew up on paper scored a touchdown. Even if it was just an inch I was trying to get, it was a 100-yard play. Can you make an argument on paper that by having this kind of tariff structure that Trump claims he wants, because we don't actually know what he wants because he's all over the map, but can we make an argument on paper that if you were to say we're tariffing everything, that it would encourage manufacturing to return to the U.S. by saying, hey, look, you want to avoid the tariffs? Simple. Make it in the U.S. Is that possible, feasible, realistic, any of that?
I understand the appeal of it. So let's just step back for a minute and say that over the last 40 years, we really have seen a hollowing out of the American middle class and of the, you know, manufacturing capacity in the United States. And the culprit of that is, yes, trade policy has been pretty bad, I think, for the last 40
Terrible.
Years. And I think that is a big chunk of it, as well as things like deliberate attacks on unions, you know, so-called right to work states that have basically undermined working people's right to collectively bargain for better wages and better, you know, to get a piece of the pie that they themselves have earned and created. And then cutting taxes for rich people and for corporations that shift jobs overseas is another part of that. So that the identification of that problem, I think, is real and is right. And the solution is to invest in middle class people and invest in manufacturing in here, because we do have the best workers in the world. We do have the best infrastructure in the world. We do have the strongest consumer market in the world. Businesses should want to build their factories here in the United States, and giving them tax breaks to shift those jobs overseas is a terrible idea. Can you tariff your way to that entirely? Absolutely not. But this is what I'm saying about tariffs can be a useful tool in targeted circumstances, for sure. But we're never going to have a thriving, you know, banana. I keep using banana as an example because it's the thing that's like, do we really think we're going to have a banana industry in the United States? Like, where is that going to go? And the other thing that we have to really grapple with seriously is that if we slap tariffs on everything, other countries are going to slap tariffs on us too. And that is a real thing as well. And look, I don't think we should necessarily shy away from an aggressive trade policy where we're saying we need to get ours. But we also need to be clear-eyed and honest that if we do a full-on tariffs on everything, taxes on every single import, that's going to happen to American exports too. And that means it's going to be a push and a pull, and it's not going to work nearly as well as Donald Trump thinks it's going to.
No, look,
and at the same time, everybody's costs are going to go up. So I just think it's going to be, frankly, I think it's going to be politically toxic too.
Which is why I don't think he's actually going to do it. I think this is just, you know, causing, you know, just throwing smoke out there to get people racing around trying to figure out what exactly he's going to do. And I don't think he's going to really do anything. Except, as you pointed out, cutting taxes for rich people. Because at the end of the day, that is the underlying goal in every scenario.
Yes, that's exactly right. And look, we have seen this before. It's not like Donald Trump wasn't president before. He was. If he believed in actually investing in American manufacturing jobs here at home, he could have done that. But what did he do in his first term? He cut taxes for billionaires and corporations. The corporate tax rate went down by a whopping 40%. That's a ridiculous tax cut. Trillions of dollars went directly into the pockets of the owners and CEOs of these giant corporations, who then turned around and gouged consumers for the following several years. Like, did they lower prices? Did they raise wages? Did they invest in American workers? No, they did not. They lined their own pockets. And that is what Donald Trump signed into law himself in 2017. And that is what he and his congressional allies are saying they are going to do again today. And look, I think people are right to be angry about the high cost of living in this country. It is crazy that we are so wealthy. We are a wealthy, wealthy country, but so much of that wealth is just concentrated at the very top that most Americans don't feel it. And the answer is to give more tax cuts to billionaires and corporations? I don't think
so. I'm right there with you. Look, Doge Boy should not be getting a tax cut, a guy who's worth almost $500 billion. Sorry, when Doge Boy tells me we need to tighten the belt a little bit, someone's priorities are a little screwed up.
Absolutely right. It's crazy to me that Donald Trump has given the literal richest person in the history of the planet the responsibility of saying which public services are expendable, whose Social Security benefits are wasteful, which veterans' benefits are just a little too much. Elon Musk should not be deciding whether public schools, safe drinking water, clean air, safe highways are worth it. Because he's got a private jet and sends his kids to private schools and doesn't need any of that stuff. He just wants his lower taxes.
Yeah, no, you're right. I got to change directions real quick. As a former OMB official, one of the nominees that Trump has thrown out is this guy, Russ Voigt. And there's a lot of concern about this guy being the budget director. How bad could this be? Because I've been saying while all this smokescreen stuff is going on, while we're following the cat laser, Trump is putting people in positions like OMB who are going to be really, really dangerous and damaging to our government. And while we're watching the cat laser, bad things are going to happen. How bad do you think this guy could be?
Well, he literally wrote the chapter in Project 2025 about OMB and the executive office.
Oh, but wait a second. Hold on. That's not Trump's plan. Yeah. Trump told us. Trump told us he had nothing to do with that.
Nothing to do with it. He just happens to nominate to OMB director the guy who literally wrote the chapter in that book about what to do. Look, Russ is a true believer when it comes to slashing public services and protections. He believes that it is wrong that rich people should pay taxes to the public benefit, to the public good. He just thinks it's wrong, and he's a true believer. And it was true when he was the budget director under Trump the first time. It's true in his private writing. He set up a separate think tank when he was out of power to propose massive cuts, including things to like cuts to like veterans' health care benefits and basic things that I think the vast majority of Americans, Republican, Democrat, Independent, all agree we should be doing, right? If you ask the American people, should we be more generous in our veterans' benefits or should we cut veterans' benefits? 80% of Americans are going to say more generous, right? But Russ vote is in the 20%. And I worry about that. Now, I think that he's going to run into the buzzsaw of American public opinion, which is always what happens when Republicans try to do what they say they want to do. They like you said, there's a lot of smoke and mirrors, but if they actually try to cut the basic protections that middle class and working people just rely on in their everyday, you know, the Small Business Administration, Title I funding for their kids' public schools, Medicaid, Medicare, if they actually try to cut these things, I think people are going to be pretty angry. And that's not what they voted for.
It's the hope. And I've been saying, look, as we've been saying on the program since Election Day, the solutions will come out of their savagery when the suffering they impose finally trickles down. The one thing that will trickle down is the pain and suffering by the policies that they impose. Maybe that's going to be that wake up moment, because I believe in this country, the only time we really come together and really react is when there's a crisis. And I believe they're about to create one.
I think there's some bad ideas that they are going to try to implement. And they, in some ways, Democrats have gotten in their way of showing the American people who they actually are for. And I think this is the next 2 years is going to be a really interesting test case in whose side are Republicans really on. They have made a big show and talked a big game of being on the side of the very folks who have been left out and left behind for the last 40 years, even though they're the ones, their policies that have left those people out, those same people out. But sure, look, Donald Trump has been effective at saying he is going to look out for people who have been left out and left behind. Well, now he's got to put his money where his mouth is. And I think we're going to see really clearly whose side he's actually on. Is he going to choose the voters who make less than $100,000 who voted for him? Or is he going to choose his big billionaire donors and corporate backers? The tax bill is going to be a perfect example to see who's he really for.
No, that we're going to see out of this big, beautiful bill where the priorities are. But Michael, as always, I appreciate you coming on the program. I hope you'll come back and keep us up to date on what's going on, especially at OMB and elsewhere.
Anytime. Thank you for having me on, and I really appreciate it.
Michael Linden, thanks so much. Senior fellow over at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth. I want to hear your thoughts. Are you ready for what's coming? Are you concerned? Or are you buying the tariff argument? I want to hear your best tariff argument. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio, WXCO, home of the Chad Holmes Show.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Cloudy tonight with scattered flurries and snow showers. Lows mid-teens. A mix of sun and clouds for tomorrow. Highs in the mid-20s. Dry Saturday. More snow possible late Saturday night and Sunday. Weekend highs in the mid to upper 20s. It's 24 right now.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
Here's what the WSJ had said after J6. This week has probably finished Donald Trump as a serious political figure. Boy, that hasn't aged well, has
it? No, not at all.
In the Wall Street Journal. So after what they just said 4 years ago, Maggie, they couldn't bring it upon themselves to say that guy who did that shouldn't be anywhere near the White House again. Nope, couldn't do it.
The Maggie Dawn Show. Weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So we're starting to hear a little bit about what might be in the big, beautiful bill. And one of the issues, the SALT deductions, the state and local tax deduction. Trump tooketh away, capped it at $10,000, now looking to give some of it back. Maybe to go up to $20,000 for a married couple. Is this a sweetener for Democrats to come along? I don't know that it's enough, but you know, again, we'll see in this game. And understand, Trump has told us this big, beautiful bill is going to somehow help us. His tariff plan is going to make America great again. And in fact, I'm hearing some weird rumblings that he's going to enact the International Economic Emergency Powers Act. And say that, you know, the country's under attack. And this will give him unilateral authority to impose his tariffs. We will see. And here to share some thoughts on, well, what we're in for. I've asked Carla Walter to come talk with us. She's a senior director of the American Worker Project there at the Center for American Progress. Carla, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you for having me.
So you buying any of this big, beautiful bill going to help working people because we're going to give you this little deduction back? Are you buying any of this?
I think that we know who Trump is actually after in terms of benefiting for the bill, and it is not working people. I think the vast majority of the bill we'll see is about you know, the very rich and corporate CEOs. And so the balance will be pretty clear, and whether or not there's pennies for the working class and working families generally is not really going to offset the balance there.
Because clearly the message of this election is, you know, the people who showed up to vote bought that Trump was going to be better on the economy. He was going to be better for workers, even though his record, his past, his former presidency was anything but that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think we can both learn from the past and we can learn from Project 2025. And we can know that to expect something that is very different, that is very much favoring the wealthy, favoring corporate interests over workers. We can expect that when it comes to labor protections and labor rights. We can expect that when it comes to trade, and we can expect that when it comes to, you know, the Department of Labor and protecting our fundamental protections like overtime and misclassification and wage protections.
But what do you say to the person who goes, well, you know, Donald Trump, his first overture is to reach a handout to labor with his labor secretary choice, who, you know, obviously the best person you're going to get out of Trump. What do you say to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, we should watch and we should see what happens. I think that with Representative Chavez or former Representative Chavez de Remer, we see that she's in favor of the PRO Act and the Public Service Freedom to Negotiate Act, which would allow workers to bargain and exercise their rights on the job. I think, though, there's a question of both how that translates into an administration-wide policy. Trump himself has called himself a right-to-work guy. So I think that there are a lot of stumbling blocks when we can't expect a DOL secretary to solve that. But then there are other really important issues that we need to ask where she stands on, whether it's enforcement of prevailing wage and minimum wage laws, misclassification, supporting robust apprenticeship programs with union involvement, coming to the defense of overtime. And I think her record is much more spotty, and we will see who Trump is appointing to that second level to oversee those programs and oversee if there are advocates there.
Because that's the thing that, you know, I keep saying, look at who he's appointing to these different agencies. For me, whoever he's going to throw at the NLRB as the general counsel there will tell me how it's going to work for labor, because I think that's maybe even a little more important than the head of the Department of Labor.
Yeah, unfortunately, we're going to see Jen Abruzzo, the current general counsel, probably fired on day one. And she has been the staunchest advocate Amazing. For working people that we could ever have. And we can guess what sort of replacement he will appoint there. And it is going to be, you know, corporate interests likely that will be set on rolling back all of her advances, whether it is advances to ensure that workers aren't subject to sitting through meetings with management just to assert their right or convince them not to assert their right to come together in unions, whether it be the important protections for joint employer, all of those things we know will be on the chopping block. And unfortunately, that will be faster because Senators Manchin and Sinema did not replace the outgoing NLRB board member or reappoint the outgoing NLRB board member. So we will not have a progressive majority in the on the board going forward either.
Now, and this is where, you know, when I hear Sean O'Brien, president of the Teamsters, say Democrats have been screwing us, I look at Sinema and Manchin as those Democrats, not the entire Democratic Party, but specifically those two in this instance, because you're right. We could have mitigated some of the damage for a bit of time by ensuring that the folks were still on the NLRB, on the board. And for some odd reason, you know, they jabbed workers in the back, in my view.
Yeah, and it'll have real consequences. Under Biden, we saw far more workers being reinstituted when they were illegally fired because of board orders. We saw union win rates climb. We can expect that when we have an anti-worker NLRB, a lot of that progress will be reversed.
And what does that mean, you know, as someone who's the director of the American Worker Project, what does that mean for workers across the board, not just union workers, but all workers? What does that mean?
Well, we know when unions are strong and in specific industries, everyone's wages are higher. We know that the NLRB doesn't just protect the right of workers that are unionized to come together and talk with each other about pay and protections, but we also know that non-union workers need those protections too, so that they can talk with their colleagues. When we don't have an active NLRB, all workers are under threat.
I'm not looking forward to the next 6 months to begin, and then, well, the next 6 months after that. But what do you make of this talk? And I just talked with Michael Linden a bit ago about tariffs and this idea that somehow Trump's going to use these tariffs, going to use the International Economic Emergency Powers Act to enact his tariffs that somehow this is going to bring manufacturing back. Because the story I've told is, you know, I've been told is this is going to bring those jobs back. And then you union people can go organize those. And we're going to recreate what my grandparents' generation built and that prosperous working class of the past. And it's all going to be because Trump and his tariffs. You buying any of that?
You know, tariffs are a tool, and they should be implemented smartly in targeted ways to support good jobs in industries that we want to support in the U.S. And so that means thinking strategically, what are the industries, and then what else are we doing? So we saw the Biden administration really lean into the fact that we're going to invest it. The federal government is also going to invest in key industries, and they're going to push those industries to be creating good union jobs. And so it is this sort of manifold approach of the government to be supporting good jobs at every juncture that really translates into real organizing power. But Trump sees this as a cudgel for his political enemies. This is about fentanyl. This is about borders. This is about, it's about X, Y, and Z, and it is not actually about manufacturing and bringing back good manufacturing jobs. And so when you see this sort of like, it is a tool that I'm going to use for everything, then it becomes a tool for nothing.
That's an excellent point. You know, because I've got friends who they seem to think come January 20th, everything's going to be great. Prices are going to come down. Wages are going to go up. All the good things are going to go up. All the bad things are going to go down. And the reality is based on what I'm seeing, based on, you know, the wide range of comments that Trump has made, a lot of the just all over the map thinking, seems to be making all the things that are bad worse and all the things that would be good, well, worse.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, overtime is a real example of the sort of risks we see of a second Trump administration. So President Biden raised the overtime threshold to a really meaningful threshold for, I think it's approximately 4 million American workers would be covered. And we saw a Texas judge that it was a Trump appointee strike that down. Now it's on DOL to defend that rule. And that is where Secretary Chavez de Remer will come in. What we can expect probably, though, if we learn from his last administration, is that won't happen. That rule will go away, and those workers who would see real-life benefits, would see the benefits, you know, that sort of like, I'll see the benefit tomorrow of my hard work, that's going to go away.
Yeah. But also, you know, you brought up overtime. I've had people tell me, well, but Rick, you know, he's not going to tax overtime.
Yeah, well, I think getting overtime is more valuable than not taxing overtime.
So when you say that, what do you mean?
I mean that in order to even have a conversation about whether or not you're getting taxed on something, first you have to collect those wages. And if you're not getting those wages in the first place, it doesn't really matter whether they're taxed or not.
So are you arguing that they're going to somehow, you know, fiddle with the system, that you're not going to get overtime ever again? Because, you know, we've become accustomed to the 40-hour work week. Me as a union guy, I've always gotten overtime after 8, thanks to my union contract. And when I started in the workforce years ago, that was the norm across the industry. We are now in that, you know, it's 40 hours, but they seem to be moving us to the 160-hour work month. is that what we're talking about?
I mean, you see, like, it's not only the rule that helps non-union workers as well collect overtime. It's also this sort of flirtation that Republicans have for a long time with comp time. So let's replace overtime with vacation that your boss may or may not approve. And I think that we know that this is the path that we're treading down. And we know that, you know, this is going to be a risk. This is a risk for workers across industries. We haven't yet talked about the risk to federal workers, too, who are really, you know, in the crosshairs and will be from the beginning. But I think all of these things are up in the air about what's going to happen.
Well, you were looking at my notes because, you know, I wanted to get your thoughts on Schedule F and the Making Patronage Great Again policy that we saw coming out of Project 2025, because I have a lot of friends in the federal workforce who are very concerned that their livelihoods are on the chopping block and that we're going to privatize large chunks of our government. And you're going to have, you know, people like Doge Boy deciding who gets jobs and doing what Doge Boy did to Twitter, which is cutting far and deep into employment, which means not only do the workers get screwed over, but we as citizens and people who need from our government, we're going to get screwed over. Do you have some idea of, I guess, what are you looking for? I mean, when this stuff rolls out, how will we know it? Will we see it right away? Any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's first the attack on federal employees unions we saw that Trump lodged last time around, whether it was, having a right to representation during discipline procedures, the ability for workers to meet public government workers to meet with each other with their union in convenient locations at convenient times. So we'll definitely see all that. Then Schedule F is next on the, on the agenda. And that is, there is going to be activity to do it. And it will, we'll see a more than 10 times increase in the number of political appointees. And as you point out, that is both about whether or not workers are able to stay on the job. Experienced, smart workers are able to stay on the job who know these programs and know how to get work done. But then, if you're having a political appointee take over the reins from somebody who's long experienced in overseeing and ensuring that unemployment insurance is working right, or workers' comp, or, all these programs, enforcement of prevailing wage, and that is being politicized, you not only have, the political payback increasing, but you also have the competence threshold plummeting for these programs that everyday Americans count on.
Yeah, I've heard people make that argument that, well, we've got the really competent people and you're going to bring incompetence in. I fear that that's not the reality. I fear that we bring in really competent people who have the explicit intention on destroying the very thing that they're in charge of. Because I watched during the whole run-up of Project 2025 and the vetting of people. The think tank world, and I'm sure as you know better than anyone, the think tank world got behind Trump early. They put out their wet dream list in a 900-page document, and they were actively seeking people for these positions in the event that Trump does this Schedule F. So I fear, and maybe you share it or maybe you don't, I fear you get really highly competent people who know what they want to do to these agencies and how bad they want to destroy them. I fear you get those people in.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's fair. I think there will be folks that are coming in there with the express purpose to destroy these programs and destroy all sorts of programs. It's not just going to be pro-worker programs. It will be the actual program that's being administered because they don't believe in government and they don't believe in government providing the sort of services that we should pay for and should expect to see. The other thing is we will see, though, that I think we're already seeing the infighting within the administration. This was like signature of the last Trump administration as well. And I think we will see the sort of like infighting and inability. And that will, to a certain extent, slow some things down. But to the extent that it's paralyzing government programs, that is also a very bad thing.
Now, in my inner circle of friends and advisors and folks that I talk to, we're running a pool on how long it is before the Trump Doge Boy divorce happens. Before the very public breakup of the bromance that's been going on between Trump and Elon Musk, I've got 3 months.
that's fair. Although we're seeing all the other like corporate interests sort of bending a knee right now too, in a way that we didn't see last time around, and so I have some real fear about what that means and who's going to be waiting in the wings to take that mantle.
Yeah. So last question I've got for you in the last line of questioning is, is there a way to stop the bad that's coming? Are Democrats going to be able to put up a resistance, or if Republicans are in line, do they ride the steamroller right over the backs of working people? And we end up back in the good old days of the 80s and 90s and not the 1980s and 90s.
It's going to be tough. It's going to be a tough 2 years because we have no power. Hopefully 2 years from now, we do have some. I think we need to take the case to everyday Americans when the administration is not living up to their, this sort of like espoused commitment to the working class. We saw that work to a limited extent the last time around when, for example, orders to allow tip stealing were like, there was an administrative effort to allow tip stealing. And there was a really successful campaign around the fact that people were sort of found this to be completely egregious. And I think we need to figure out ways to strategically break through. But at the same time, I think we also need to be fighting at the state and local level for some of the protections that we need. And I think those state and local fights will be essential. We won't be able to win every single one of them, but for the ones we can win, we can make a difference to working people.
You know, I had forgotten all about the tip stealing thing. It's amazing how he went from employers can steal tips to we're not going to tax them. I'm stunned we're in the position we're in, that given the 4 years that we lived under during Trump, he's back.
And he's back, and, you know, the conversations are crazier than ever. So we're talking about renaming the Gulf of Mexico and buying up Greenland. So, like, I think that there is also this, like, how do we break through the noise and really sort of get the stakes of what's happening across to working people?
And that is our goal over the next 4 years. I want to try and stay away from the chaos and focus on our lives getting better. And when they're not, offering solutions on how, when we get rid of this, how we actually move forward. Because as I've been saying, the solutions will come out of the savagery of their suffering. And we'll see. But Carla, as always, I appreciate the work that you guys do there at the American Worker Project. Great stuff. Hope people check out the website, AmericanProgress.org. But Carla Walter, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Anytime. I want to hear your thoughts. Are you excited about the coming 4 years? Are you excited about the potential of across-the-board tariffs? And maybe we're going to bring tip stealing back. I want to hear your thoughts. Rick at the RickSmithShow.com. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. Do national security concerns outweigh the right of workers to form a union? That question was being debated on this day in labor history. The year was 2003. The head of the Transportation Security Administration, James Loy, made the case that collective bargaining would be an impediment to the war on terrorism. He signed an order that prohibited unionization by passenger and baggage screeners. The move was just one of several that eroded federal workers' rights in the name of national security in the aftermath of 9/11. The TSA was founded in the months after the 9/11 attacks by the Bush administration. Prior to the TSA, screening was done by private contractors run by the airlines. With the new organization, more than 45,000 screeners became part of the federal workforce. Massachusetts Senator Teddy Kennedy disagreed with the Bush administration's position that these workers could not join a union. He released a statement saying, "It's not Homeland Security, it's union busting." The TSA workers did not give up their fight to join a union. For the better part of a decade, they continued to organize and make their case. In 2011, the workers voted to become part of the American Federation of Government Employees. It was the largest union election by federal workers in United States history. There are limitations to the union, however, such as the screeners cannot go on strike, but the union can advocate for safe and fair workplace conditions. When the union was finally recognized, president of AFGE John Gage issued a statement. He declared, "Today marks the recognition of a fundamental human right for 40,000 patriotic federal employees who have been disenfranchised since the inception of the agency. Today, nearly 16,000 screeners have joined the union." Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
I gotta tell you, I had forgotten all about the tip stealing of the last Trump administration. Just like, you know, during the break, I'm thinking about, you know, the person that he had put in charge of the wage and hour division, the people who go after wage theft. That person was accused of wage theft. And, you know, all of those things are going to come back. All those stories, all that chaos is going to be back. And ultimately, it's not going to help working people. It's not going to help us. And as I've been saying, look, you know, come January 20th, we're going to be told, you know, from that point forward, greatest economy ever. And he may actually invoke the International Economic Emergency Powers Act to do his tariffs. And if he does, he'll do it in some way. This is where my mind is going. He'll do it in some way that he can immediately claim it's making things better, and can immediately claim with a couple companies, you know, announcing some investments, see, look, it's working. The question is, will those jobs be real? Will the investment actually happen? And will it trickle down to average everyday working people? His record, not good on this. Not good at all. We lived through it. We saw the rhetoric. We saw what a good PR pitch guy can do. He is, and this is where I give him credit. He's special. He's special in that he can convince his supporters that they're better off when actually they were worse off. He can convince them that what they saw with their own eyes didn't happen. I've joked he could sell a woman wearing white gloves in her wedding dress in the desert. He could sell her a ketchup popsicle. Our job going forward, our mission going forward, is to pay attention to what is real instead of what's being thrown at us, the chaos that he will bring. And we're going to see these fights. I joke that, you know, the bromance between Trump and Doge Boy, that's gonna come to a head. We're already hearing reports that Trump's tired of having him around so much. That could be an interesting sideshow. And part of me goes, would it be planned? Is it something that's wanted? Because understand, the think tank world, the billionaire-funded think tank world, they're all in. All of the things they've been dreaming about doing, and I've said this before, they're going to get an opportunity to move on. And not just legislatively, but from inside the machine. They are going to have access to the very real power of the organizations. And not just the director, but of the marching of the soldiers. One of the things that caught my attention about Project 2025 from the very beginning, and I think we were one of the few places talking about it before the mainstream media picked it up. I picked it up because of the fact that they were recruiting people for different jobs. Send us your resume. And while you're sending us your resume, send us your social media accounts and send us all this information so we can properly vet you. They were already building an army of minions to go in and do the bureaucratic work. The person that answers the phone. They were already thinking about how to destroy the machine from within. And which is why I say, you know, where they're making patronage great again, because you've got to be sufficiently loyal to get one of these positions going forward. It's no longer going to be about a civil service exam. It's no longer going to be about competence for sure. It's going to be about loyalty first and foremost. And as I said with Carla, my fear is that the loyalty, yes, you're going to get the most loyal, but that they are competent. And that their goal in the swinging door of our government is to destroy and reap rewards on corporate interests, so that they can then swing out of government and into very lucrative corporate roles and being paid for their allegiance. Thanked, if you will. Because corporate America hates government. Well, at least government that holds them accountable. They love a government that bails them out when they screw things up. They love a government that aids them in holding off competition. They love that. But any accountability, they'll have none of. So for me, the concern, and it should be for all federal workers and all citizens, ultimately it's all about we the citizens, is how much damage can they do within? We're going to see. We're going to see the movie happen. We're going to see fascism American style. We're going to see what blind loyalty does. And what a business government looks like. And why? Because we didn't want to vote for the black woman. That's what I come up with. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. What are you paying attention to over the next several weeks and months? rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast, wherever you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. Also, check out freespeech.org for our video content. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@thericksmithshow.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio. WXCO 1230 AM. W255DN Wausau. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. Three of the five wildfires burning in Los Angeles County, California, are 0% contained. At least seven people have died in the Palisades and Eaton fires, and authorities say at least 9,000 structures have been damaged or destroyed in those two wildfires. This woman in Altadena lost her home.
We had everything, like the sentimental things. Like, my mom passed away. I had only a few things of hers left. My wedding dress, our wedding album, we left everything.
L.A. Fire Chief Kristen Crowley.
If I had 1,000 engines to throw at this fire, I honestly don't think 1,000 engines at that very moment could have tapped this fire down.
CBS's